Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we discuss technology, science, and the future of our environment. Most people probably would not consider buying a 2025 model of a vehicle if it didn't come with a radio and had hand crank windows. But there's already a sizable waiting list for the Slate EV, an all-new electric truck that won't roll off the assembly lines until at least next year. The company's goal is to offer total customization at an extremely affordable price for an electric vehicle. Here to tell us more is John Lincove, Consumer Reports Deputy Content Editor for Autos. Welcome to Tech Tuesday, John.
Thank you, Amy. Thanks for having me here.
So for just to start, tell us more about Slate. This is a company that is backed by Amazon multi-billionaire Jeff Bezos. What made him attempt to get, why did he get into the auto industry here? Why is Bezos involved with this?
It is kind of boggling the mind because, you know, you only hear negatives about the auto industry and all the complexity and the challenges. But he saw a low-cost opportunity, likely, in the sense of gone are the super affordable vehicles. You know, you're not going to the dealer and buying a new car in the teens. You know, maybe right around 20,000, you're getting something small. And it'll be a small sedan, you know, not even an SUV. And it'll be front wheel drive and it'll be very stripped down. So he saw an opportunity to have something that's going to hit the pickup truck market in you know, the low cost, very utilitarian, but very useful pickup truck market, but also with the conversion ability to make it an SUV, because SUVs are, you know, continue to grow in sales at the expense of sedans. So he saw a niche. Whether it comes to fruition and it's all delivered on time, let's wait and see.
Yeah, and is another reason maybe Bezos jumped in here because he even personally wants to compete with Tesla and Elon Musk? That's hard to know.
It could be, you know, the motivations of the billionaire class is hard to do these days. It could be just, you know, a new frontier, so to speak. You know, he goes to space, now he's going to go to the roads. But it's the opposite of where Tesla is, in the sense of it's the every person's car. It's something that, you know, even a new to the job market person, and I'm not making assumptions on salaries and such, but you know, someone starting out could afford this vehicle much more so than a $45,000 small compact SUV or something like that, let alone an electric vehicle, because you know, all of those are you know, definitely up, you know, aside from the Nissan Leaf and maybe one other, they're all, you know, $35,000, $45,000, $55,000 vehicles. Here's an opportunity to have something very entry level that everyone can touch.
So one of the biggest draws of the vehicle is the price point, which starts at about $27,000, but the price can be lower if you have an EV tax credit. Is that right?
That is, yes. Yeah. So because it'll be built in the United States, anything that you're not assembling, because there is some assembly required aspect to the Slate, but it's all going to be manufactured in the United States, supposedly. So it would qualify for the tax credits that are in place now. As has been reported on NPR and elsewhere and chatter online, who knows what the administration will do. You know, the $7,500 tax credit is not something that is popular with the current administration. And they've done a lot as far as cutting back on money for EV chargers and such like that. So who knows what will be in place when it comes, when the vehicle goes on sale.
Now, you mentioned that it's being manufactured in the United States. Can we make the whole thing an EV vehicle here in the U.S.?
Is it possible for a auto manufacturer to do that? Certainly. Mm-hmm. You know, what the interesting thing is that, okay, who's going to be manufacturing the parts as the suppliers? You know, if it's because the parts will be built in the US, will avoid any kind of tariff that are in place right now. It certainly is. And keeping it at a low price point is a big part of it, because that's always been the headache for manufacturing in the United States, is that, we have the higher standard of living and we have higher salaries, and then that's why manufacturers go overseas. So yeah, to be able to do but that's why you're also seeing such a bare bones type of vehicle. You're not seeing a radio. You provide all of the audio, the audio equipment, which is maybe an iPhone from China, or a Samsung device from overseas, and then a Bluetooth speaker, and who knows where that was built. Like, the onus on having anything that is tariffable is going to be on the consumer who buys it, and that's why it's stripped down, and that's it's why it's so simplistic, and that way they avoid any of those costs.
Yeah, and to make it so cheap, this EV vehicle, that's how they did it, is it has no radio. Another example of something it doesn't have, it has hand crank windows. Is I have to imagine that, I mean, we laugh at that, but is that what else is in it? What else is not in it, I guess, that's making it cheaper?
Well, right. So it's those. It's not going to be a lot of power equipment for the seats, and multi-adjustability. You don't have a sunroof, anything like that. The crank windows you can install. The bonus of this is that consumers don't have to give up all the creature comforts. You can add in, you can add in power windows, for example. So you don't have to be like, the 1970s in the back seat of the family wagon going into the beach. And my kids, for example, would have to actually learn what the heck those cranks do, and how
Indeed,
to lower a window. So you can add that type of thing in. There's only the only screen is a gauge cluster with a speedometer. It's placed conventionally, thankfully. I mean, what they've shown in the images is that it's behind the steering wheel, so you're not stuck. Like, and we go back to Tesla, or we'll go to Rivian, or we'll go to other automakers where everything's in the center screen. But yeah, knobs for the climate control, and air conditioning is standard, so the total nod to the U.S. market. There's buttons, there's a column shifter, there's a little place for your phone. But again, it's minimalist, but it gets rid of all the kind of accoutrements, the doodads that distract and take away from the act of driving.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we're talking about the new Slate EV, an all-new electric truck that is also customizable. With us is John Lincove, Consumer Reports Deputy Content Editor for Autos. So we're calling it a truck, but you can also convert it. So I guess you can pay more to close that truck bed and turn it into an SUV, right?
Right. So if you decide to get the kit, basically what happens is when the vehicle is delivered to you, and will there be a dealership? Will there be just a pickup location? Is it end up being like Carvana, and
Amazon brings it to you. That's what I'm thinking.
does a giant drone come and drop it on your in the front side of
I
your
want it on
driveway?
my porch, yes.
Right. It's going to collapse a lot of porches when people have front porch delivery. So once it's there, if you get the vehicle in with that kit, it'll be in the back. I mean, literally, the pickup truck bed will be doing service even before you take service, take the vehicle, delivery of the vehicle. And then you put that together. So it has a roll bar that you have to add in. It has a little cap in the back. It has a slanted window that will, more traditional SUV style. The one thing it doesn't do, it doesn't add doors. So you're stuck with it's a two-door vehicle. So think like the old, like probably a safer, like the Geos and Suzukis and all the smaller vehicles, kind of like the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, where they're like little two-door SUVs, with almost jump seats in the back. This is kind of going to be like that if you just opt for the SUV package for it.
So how many seats does it have? If you get the truck, it has two, and then if you add the back part, do you have four seats or?
You have four seats total, yes.
But if it stays the truck, you only have two, right?
If it stays a truck, it's just two. It's just consider it would be like the basic cab pickup truck. You see some of these older, and again, you're looking like 70s, 80s pickup trucks. For example, we referenced on consumerreports.org the Chevrolet Love, the Ford Courier, the Datsun 620. I mean, these are like very basic runabout trucks that were really, you would see them maybe an auto parts store would use it, a delivery service in your town would use it. Before you got into the Amazons and the other UPSs and such coming and making immediate deliveries, this is what the local place would use. They'd throw stuff in the back of it and take it to a store, take it to the house, whatever.
Now, it reminded me when I looked at, you can go to the website right now and you can like look at pictures, look at different colors, look at the customization. It kind of looked a little bit like, do you remember the Subaru Baja from a long time ago? Yes.
Yeah, definitely,
Yeah,
definitely.
like that was a little like looked like a Subaru in the front, but it had a little tiny truck bed. It wasn't super popular. I think it just I don't know, it ended up being one of those cars that people made fun of eventually.
Yeah, the Baja and the Brat, they were limited, and that's kind of the Brat was the original one, and then you had the kind of reincarnation of the Baja, it was a bigger one. And it was in an era where, in my opinion, the world was going with pickup trucks, like bigger, better. And we're still in that world of, taller hoods, raised ride height, bigger cabins. The beds aren't particularly giant and useful in a crew cab, short bed pickup truck. You have to get into longer beds to be real work trucks. And then there's dimension things, but the price of them has gone up so much that there has been this push of ha going back to that. So you have the Hyundai Santa Cruz is close to what the Subaru was like, and the Ford Maverick has been incredibly popular because it's gone back to those days of like what a small truck really is. Small trucks have gotten big, mid-sized trucks have gotten giant, and full-size trucks are just immense. This is going back to those days of a small one, and that's kind of where you are with the Slate. It's a small pickup truck. You could It's nimble. You can use it for mulch. You could use it for Home Depot. You could use it for putting a couple bikes, mountain bikes in the back, or attaching it. But it's not going to take a. You don't have to park it outside of a garage. If you happen to have a garage, you're not forced to park it in the driveway overnight because the thing is just too big to fit inside it.
Now, earlier you mentioned safety. Has anything been compromised in terms of safety to keep it so affordable and so bare bones?
Well, so the basic the first answer is going to be that remains to be seen. I mean, it's going to have, according to Slate, a goal. It has a goal of top safety ratings. I mean, any manufacturer that brings out a vehicle and says like, "Nah, we're going for almost top, but we're going for good enough in the safety rating," that's not going to happen. So it's nice that they say that they're aiming for top safety ratings. But it will have automatic emergency braking as standard equipment. Unfortunately, it's not able to add, where consumers can't add blind spot warning, for example, which people have told us in surveys that they really do like blind spot warning. Certainly, automatic emergency braking, that's going to stop you from hitting someone who slams on the brakes in front of you, or deer running out, or something like that. But blind spot warning is that one where you miss that vehicle that's in your corner, just out of sight. You turn your head, and then all of a sudden something zipped up. And that they people really like that. It's not intrusive where it steers the vehicle, but it's an alert and it's an extra set of eyes. People really like that. So it is a little bit of a shame that you can't have that at this point on the Slate. But who knows? I mean, again, it's been introduced. Auto manufacturers, and so Amazon's now going to be an auto manufacturer, notorious for changing things, adding, subtracting, modifying before the actual vehicle is delivered.
What about a backup camera? I lived for many, many, many decades without a backup camera, but now I have one, and I would never go back.
So a backup camera is mandatory. It is it's required by the government to have a rear view camera, and that would it, since it only has the small display and the gauges, going to assume that it's something that will be attached to your phone. It may replace the image in the gauge cluster, but that is a requirement for all vehicles to have the backup camera.
Okay. Now, let's talk a little bit about the waiting list. It's not supposed to come out for a year or so, but there's already people who have basically set up pre-orders, right?
Sure. Yeah. The way now, and what will be interesting with Amazon to see where Amazon falls into this is just like what Tesla, just like what Rivian, Lucid, all of these much more expensive EV manufacturers are facing is how they're going to handle the dealership experience. So you can go online, you put your name on the list, you make your nominal deposit. I think it's a few hundred dollars for your deposit. And then you wait, and then as the time approaches, they'll reach out to you. Ford did that with the Maverick. They built up the hype of it, but they had an online reservation system, and Honda did it with the Prologue EV. So it's becoming more and more common. But of course, with those, you're then handed off by Ford or by Honda to a local dealer. Here, it's going to be you're going to interact with the company directly, and then there'll be a maybe a delivery center or something like that. Or again, like we were joking before, one day the drone will show up and drop it off. But you'll do everything online. It sounds great because we're so used to doing everything online. Click, buy, add my cart, it shows up, easy peasy. But the downside of it is that you don't go in and talk with someone. I mean, when I was buying the Maverick for Consumer Reports to test, because we buy all the products that we test and we do it anonymously, the staff members actually go out and buy the products. I went down to the Ford dealer at one point with my reservation and said, like, hey, what's going on? I'm getting these messages. I need you to talk with me. When I was doing it with Rivian, I was calling in and getting voicemails. I was sending a message and getting a thanks for contacting us. We'll get back to you. So, you do run that risk of it's nice to do it from the seat of your desk or, the comfort of your couch, but you're going to face for a 20 something thousand dollar product sometimes the same customer service that you get when you're buying a $19 product. They're both online and they're both nameless and faceless.
Well, before we end here, we can't spend time talking about the auto industry without mentioning tariffs. And I know you said that this Slate EV is slated to be slated. There, I did it.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't even mean
Got that
to.
out of the way.
Is going to be made in the United States, so tariffs might not be an issue. But where are we at right now with tariffs in the auto industry? Just, give us a thumbnail of, today at this moment in time, which is always changing.
Yeah, sure. So right now we have manufacturers that have talked about raising prices. Subaru was the most recent one. They came out today saying that they're going to be raising prices on some of their models by a few $1,000s. On March 26th, the White House announced a 25% tariff on new cars and parts made outside the U.S. Then on April 9th, everything except those involving China were paused for 90 days. The administration's supposedly currently negotiating with China about that. It's sent everything into a tizzy, if you will. Not yet a tailspin because people are running out and they're buying vehicles. They want to avoid any kind of markup on that. You have some manufacturers, I mean, high end, like for example, Ferrari is saying, yeah, we're passing it all to you. Have fun. But they don't have to, their clientele doesn't matter. On the other hand, you have manufacturers like such as Ford and Subaru. They're making incremental modifications, maybe not across the board. Maybe not, they're not going to slap it 100% of the tariff rate on their most popular vehicle because they don't want to stop that from selling, but they're not going to take the cheapest vehicle and slap it on there because that would just kill its sale. So they're going to piecemeal it out here, piecemeal it out there. And then it all depends on what they get from their suppliers. Will their suppliers eat some of the cost so that Ford doesn't have to then have to eat all the costs? It really is. I mean, it's like the news cycle, spinning around day by day, something new. It's the same way for them because they have to plan so far in advance for parts delivery, what they're the amount of money they have to pay to have the parts come into the country and that's held, and then they get the it is very complicated. It's a mess. It really is a mess.
Well, like any good local NPR host, I have a Subaru, but I bought it last year, so I dodged a bullet there. So when I
Yeah.
heard that
No,
announcement this
certainly.
morning, I thought, okay, well, good, glad I have mine. So I guess we'll see.
It is, and it comes on top of the fact that, used cars are still very strong, and the average new car price was already in the high 40, $48,000, $49,000. It bounced around month to month. Some of that's artificial because of expensive pickup trucks and ex other expensive cars that we're selling based on the economy. You had people buying more expensive vehicles, that's lifting it up. But you're going to see that if there is a tariff slap, let's say a manufacturer slaps $4,000 on all of their cars, well, used car prices are going to lift too because all of a sudden people are going to turn there and you're going to have not a run and not a glut, but you're going to have a lot of interest in what happens with that. When someone sees that something's popular, they're going to raise the prices there. So it's going to be hard to escape the tariff one way or the other. Either it's tariffed or someone's taking advantage of tariffs and raising prices.
Well, thank you, John Lincove, Consumer Reports Deputy Content Editor for Autos. Thanks for joining us today.
Amy, it was my pleasure and honor. Thank you so much.
And coming up, we're going to talk about online gambling. And it's also known as iGaming, iLottery. There's a push to bring it to Ohio. That's when All Sides and Tech Tuesday continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. A new Ohio law is looking to allow Ohioans to buy lottery tickets and play casino games from smartphones, tablets, and on laptops. If passed, Ohio would join seven other states that allow online gambling, also known as iGaming. Joining us now to discuss this gambling expansion is Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks for joining us, Jeremy.
Hi, Amy. Great to be here.
So Republican State Senator Nathan Manning chairs the Legislative Committee on Gaming. And last week he introduced this bill. It's massive, 700 pages, well, 701 pages, to allow iGaming. What is iGaming? How is it different than what's already allowed with like sports betting in Ohio?
Well, it's online gambling. So casino games, online poker, online roulette, online craps, things like that. Right now, that's simply not allowed. If you want to play poker online, you're not going to do it legally, not in Ohio. You would have to go to a casino, a brick and mortar casino to do that. So this bill would really legalize three things. It would legalize those kind of casino games. It would legalize online betting on horse races, either real horse races or simulated horse races. Or it would, in addition to that, it would also legalize online lottery games. So eventually, like Powerball, Mega Millions, you could buy a ticket online, and other like instant win games for the Ohio lottery, you would be able to do that. So it would do those three things.
Now, to be completely honest, I truly had no idea you couldn't gamble on your phone, because when sports betting started, I just assumed that everything was allowed. But I guess it's one of those things where if you never try it, you didn't know you couldn't, I guess. Is this a big leap from sports betting to all of these other gambling things?
It's the logical next step. So over the past 15 years, Ohio has gradually loosened its restrictions on gambling, starting with when Ohio voters allowed those four casinos in different parts of the state. And then, as you said, a couple of years ago, they legalized sports betting. But this is the next step. And as you said, seven states have legalized online gambling like this. And about 13 states, I believe, have some sort of iLottery or online lottery games.
So seven other states already allow it. Ohio is not known for being a leader of the pack when it comes to things, you know. Do you see us, you know, are we just joining suit? Is that
no
are you surprised?
Intended.
Yeah, so, yeah. Are you surprised that Ohio has jumped into this so soon? I guess is what I'm saying.
Since... Well, the main allure of this is the money, and this will, if passed, it's expected to bring in hundreds of millions of dollars to the state. And lawmakers, Republican lawmakers especially, are looking to use this right now. I think they're talking about either for an income tax cut or possibly for to fund a new Cleveland Browns stadium or other stadium projects, which is a recurring
about the Browns,
theme.
Yes.
It's always about the Browns, but also other stadium projects too, like the Bengals renovation. So that hasn't been decided yet. We should make sure to say that this is a proposed law and it has not passed yet. There's no guarantee that this will pass, but it remains to be seen because a lot of lawmakers and certainly Mike DeWine, the governor of Ohio, have many problems with and many concerns with legalizing online gaming. that the effect it'll have on gambling addiction. Because if, as Speaker Matt Huffman said the other day, well, if you're on your patio, you can just kind of gamble away your life savings, and he doesn't want to do that. Although I would say that this bill, Senator Manning's bill, would limit wagers up to $500 per week. So there would be a cap on it.
Okay. Now, the bill I mentioned is 701 pages. That's a lot of pages. Is that how many pages it takes? Is there so many rules and regulations with something like this?
There's a lot in here. And because it's not only about what exactly it lays out, for example, it has a definition of what bingo is. And if you're thinking about writing a legal definition of explaining what the game bingo is, it takes a couple of pages to say what it is.
It's more than just going to a church basement and playing bingo.
Right. To say, well, you have a grid of 5x5 square, you know, and actually laying, and you get a free space and all that. So it actually lays it out. And then, of course, then it has to lay out not only what is legalized, but what would happen to the money. So it would put a 36% tax on online gambling revenue. So people who bet wouldn't pay the money, but the gambling companies that run it, the casinos and racinos that exist in Ohio, would be allowed to do this. And they would pay a 36% tax. And if they delegated to a vendor, that would go up to 40%. And then they would have to pay $50 million initially for an initial five-year license. And you know, so this would raise a significant amount of money pretty quickly, and then it's expected to bring in a lot more money down the line.
And this just got introduced recently, but how are casinos reacting to it? Is there a concern about people not going to physical casinos if they can do everything on their iPad on their back deck?
Well, casinos would stand to benefit from this because they would be the ones to get the licenses. And the racinos, so there's four casinos, several racinos. In addition, the bill would reduce sports betting tax, the state's sports betting tax from 20% to 10%, but only for brick-and-mortar facilities, like the sports books that existing casinos have, because they haven't been very profitable. And the state recently raised the tax to 20%, and so it cut into the profit margin. So there's some ameliorations there, and casinos would definitely be the ones to benefit from this.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we're talking about increasing gambling in Ohio by allowing iGaming and iLottery. With us is Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Let's talk for a second about that iLottery piece. Would you be able to buy lottery tickets for, like, the Powerball on your phone, or can you do a scratch-off on your phone?
I wouldn't recommend using a quarter to scratch off your laptop screen,
right.
But I, under the bill, at least as written, Powerball and Mega Millions would be able to be played online a year after the bill takes effect.
Okay.
After it takes effect, I would imagine the lottery could either create its own specialty online games or have some sort of instant win games. It would not allow things like Pick 3, Pick 4, Pick 5, Classic Lotto. Those would not be allowed as written under the bill.
So you'd still have to go to the counter at the convenience store and buy the ticket.
You would, yeah. And there's also some sort of to help the existing brick and mortar agents that sell, you know, your local gas station that sells lottery tickets. They would the lottery would have to give 3.5% of its revenue every 3 months to those sales agents. The reasoning behind it is, if you look at other states, for example, I talked to the lottery director in Virginia, who said that as it introduced lottery to a lot more people, and as they got more comfortable playing lottery as a result of playing online, they would then go to the store and buy a physical ticket. So it resulted not only in more revenue from online, but then it raised sales of brick and mortar, like actual physical tickets, too.
Now, let's talk a little bit more about the money. So the bill sponsor says that the revenue in the first year is projected to be $300 million, but in a fully mature market, we're talking more like between $600 and $900 million. That is real money. That's a lot of money. How would that help Ohio's budget?
Well, again, they're looking to spend it. So it would go into the general revenue fund, except for 1% that would go to problem gambling efforts. Mm-hmm. But then right now, lawmakers are looking at spending this for a couple of things. And again, if one would be an income tax cut to, right now there's two income tax brackets. It would lower the higher income tax bracket, so people making over $100,000 a year, it would lower that to 2.75%, which is what the lower tax bracket is. That's one thing. And then again, another thing that has been talked about, and it remains, it's TBD, is for use for stadium projects. The Browns, for example, have been asking the state for $600 million, and the House, the Ohio House, has proposed doing that via bonds. But then in the Senate, that seems to get a cooler reception. This would be a way to give that $600 million without issuing bonds, which would cost the state about $400 million in interest.
Had Senator Manning been working on this bill, or is it just a coincidence that it's coming up whenever all of this debate is happening with the Browns in the Senate? Or do you know that had he been planning on introducing this?
He's been working on it for a while, and this actually follows...
To make it 700 pages, I guess he's been working on it for
This isn't something he dashed off on a whim on the back of a napkin.
Yeah.
This follows a report issued a year or two ago by a study commission that the legislature set up into this, and it actually said a lot of what the arguments are for it, which is if you legalize it, yeah, there's some concerns about addiction, but overall it would have a beneficial effect and it would help brick and mortar places as well. And so Senator Manning is the bill he introduced in response to that. Now there's another House bill that State Representative Brian Stewart from Pickaway County said he's going to introduce. That has not come out yet, so we need to see what that
similar
will do.
About this, though. Yeah, similar to this.
It remains to be seen.
Okay.
It's not a done deal. Okay. It's not a done deal exactly. So this is a starting point. It's probably going to end up in the budget. You think 700 pages is long.
Yeah.
The budget right now is 5,000 pages, and it might end up dumped into that. Because if you're going to pay for an income tax cut or a Browns stadium, both of which would probably go in the budget, you're going to throw this in there too.
Interesting. Okay. And then Manning also said that there's estimates out there that that we're already spending between like $600 million to even $2.2 billion on illegal websites. So this is money that we're losing, like Ohio has it to gain. Because I guess there's that much illegal gambling?
I guess so. That's one of the main arguments given for it, which is, hey, people are going to gamble already. Mm-hmm. And, online poker, online, gambling. And so we might as well acknowledge it. And so we can regulate it and the state can make some money off of it and tax it. Mm-hmm. It's funny. It's actually pretty similar to the argument for legalizing marijuana, mm-hmm. which a lot of state lawmakers who are, were pretty resistant to. That idea, and now it remains to be seen what they think about this new gambling idea.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that 1% of the money does go to Ohio's Problem Gambling Helpline. Mm. Have you reached out to them? Are they worried about seeing a big increase in gambling with this addition?
I've heard, I haven't reached out to that group specifically, mm-hmm. but I have heard from people who are very concerned about this. And as Speaker Huffman said, as I said earlier, if you're on your back patio, and you can just wager $500 a week, mm-hmm. that makes it a lot easier. It really lowers the barrier to gambling. Instead of having to physically go to a casino or physically go to buy a lottery ticket or what have you, so that is something that will have to be weighed. And the governor too. It remains to be seen what the governor will think. The governor has been, I guess, maybe you could describe it as begrudgingly accepting of legalized gambling in general.
Yeah.
And while the governor hasn't said, he declined to say what he thought about this particular proposal so far, he in general is kind of skeptical about, in general, he's not the biggest fan of things like legalized gambling.
And a part of what softened the blow of adding sports betting is that there are some regulations around it. The apps tell you how long you've been logged in for. It sets limits on when and how much you can bet. So you mentioned that this iGaming bill also has limits. You said $500 a week. Are there other ways to set limits, or is that the main limit setter?
Well, another main limit, too, is that it would require sites to verify identities of and their eligibility. So people would have to be 21 years old or older mm-hmm. to gamble. And so then you would have to show proof of that, via driver's license or something like that, to do that, to make sure. It would also set limits. For example, there could not be advertising for gambling around college campuses, or mm-hmm. no billboards or other advertising geared towards children. Mm-hmm. So it would set limits like that, too.
And did you say you talked with Virginia? They already have this in effect?
They do, yeah. They're, well, that's for iLottery, and mm-hmm. they're one of the 13 states that have already legalized this.
Okay. Are they seeing a lot of money? Does it...
their revenue has been higher than expected, and it remains to be seen, though. These are estimates, mm-hmm. and it remains to be seen if people will actually do this.
Yeah. So, okay. So what's next? The Senate has to consider this bill. There'll be hearings, and or they stick it into the budget.
Yeah. So there's already a hearing. There's going to be other hearings, because right now the Senate is behind the scenes they're making revisions to the budget. Mm-hmm. I anticipate early next month they're going to release the first round of changes to the budget, and we'll see if this is included in there or what happens. And then by the end of the month, they pass a final budget. And then it goes from there. It'll if that happens and the governor signs it, it'll take effect in 90 days, which means September.
Okay. And we could see a companion bill in the House, but we're just not sure yet whether that's going to happen or what it will look like.
Well, again, Brian Stewart has said he's going to introduce that, but it just hasn't shown up yet.
Okay. Well, we'll have to keep track of it and see where it ends up with both being a standalone bill and being in the budget. But I want to thank you for your time today. That is Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks for coming in, Jeremy.
Thanks so much.
And coming up, we're going to talk with Russell Hawley about some expensive new releases from both Sony and Motorola. That's when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is a show where we talk about technology, science, and the future of our environment. Sony has released another version of their famous headphones, and they aren't getting any cheaper. Also, Motorola has made an announcement with an expensive release, and Google's I/O conference starts today. We're talking about it all with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So the XM4 and XM5 Sony headphones have been one of the most popular headphones out there. People even wear them not just as headphones, but wear them as a fashion accessory. So do you think that Sony's new XM6 will continue this trend?
They absolutely will. These are, in every possible way that it can be measured, the best set of headphones that you can own. They have incredible noise canceling tech. The microphones in them are really great for calling, even if you're walking through a crowded airport. The transparency, function on it so that you can hear other people around you while you're, walking around is also, some of the best in its class. And they're just crazy comfortable to wear.
Now, they're going to be more expensive, though, than the 4s and the 5s. How much more?
These are $50 more expensive than their predecessors, which puts them at about $450 instead of the $400 that they were available for before. And that is an incredible amount of money to spend on just about anything, much less a pair of headphones, unless you are the kind of person who wears headphones, mm-hmm. Between 10 and 15 hours a day, or you travel a ton and you need headphones to, block out the sound of airplanes and things like that. There are certain people where these headphones are genuinely worth it. But I think for folks who are, maybe sitting in an office all day and that's kind of the only time you use your headphones, maybe this is more of a luxury than a need.
Yeah. I'm sitting here next to, in my studio, three pairs of Sony headphones, but they are definitely not upwards of $400 a piece. I can tell you that much.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Sony headphones have a history of being, some of the best that you can get for a reason, especially studio headphones like the ones that you're using. If you want, really high end wireless headphones, There are really only two or three brands that you can, you know, kind of go to, and they rotate, it seems like, every couple of years by which one has that like best slot. And it's pretty clear for this year the answer is going to be Sony.
Now, if you have a 4 or a 5, do you need the 6? Is there a noticeable difference?
No, you don't. I would say that if you are the kind of person who owns a 5, the Sony XM5s, that there is probably some FOMO going on there. As far as, you know, having recently made a purchase that is now no longer the best thing that Sony makes, I would say the differences between the XM5 and the XM6 are really more based on how comfortable the headphones are, as well as how nice the microphones are, specifically when taking phone calls or listening in the transparency mode. But I would say otherwise, the differences are fairly subtle.
Now, these headphones are worn a lot amongst students. Do you think the price increase will affect its popularity, or will students find the money?
We live in a world where everything is slightly more expensive than it was a couple of months ago. So I would say that everyone's kind of, you know, choosing very carefully what, you know, purchases they're going to make, at the concern that those prices would continue to increase. And Sony is not an American company, and it's unlikely that their headphones will ever be entirely manufactured here in the States. So I would imagine that price is going to fluctuate quite a bit. I would say if you know, having really great headphones is super important to you, then these are certainly ones to consider. There's just a very small group of people where these headphones are a must own.
Mm. Now, the AirPod Maxes, those are also expensive. Are they more than the Sonys?
They are at their full price, right around the same price as the Sonys, and they are about half as good. The noise cancellation in them isn't very good. The microphones that are in them are fine. The battery life on them is not nearly as good as what Sony is offering here. The thing that you get with the AirPods Max, which Apple has not refreshed in a couple of years now, is really just that they work really well within the Apple ecosystem. So if you own a MacBook, if you own an iPad or something like that, then they work really well in that context. But these will work much better everywhere.
Okay. I was wondering, why is Apple allowed to be more expensive but have less features? But is it the answer just because they're Apple?
Yeah. Once you put that Apple logo on it, you'd be surprised how much you can charge for it.
All right. Well, this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is Tech Tuesday. With us is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Another expensive device that has been released is from Motorola. And Russell, I had no idea that people still wanted flip phones. Why are we doing a flip phone?
Flip phones have really been making a comeback over the last little while in two different ways, actually. There are some that are the flip phones that, you know, kind of remove our connection to things like social media and give us just the basics with some of the kind of quote-unquote smart flip phones that exist. And then there are the ones that Motorola and Samsung make with their Galaxy Flip and, in this case, Motorola Razr phones. These are phones that are kind of a candy bar design that fold in half so that they fit really well in the pocket, and they have a great big screen on the front that allows you to do a couple of things without having to actually open the phone all the way. And these have been, you know, growing in popularity over the last couple of years, but they do still have a lot of the same, issues. By taking that phone and folding it in half, you lose a couple of things. And one of those things is durability. Mm. The way that the screen folds is super cool, but we also know that in 2 years, you'll really notice the crease on that screen. It'll make it, you know, just kind of a little awkward to use. And in some cases, things like dust and sand and water can get in there and really do some damage because they're not perfectly sealed devices the same way that a normal Samsung or Motorola or even Apple phone would be.
Now, this is just basically like a smartphone that a lot of people have, but you can fold it in half, right? That's what it looks like. It's just a thin phone and you can fold it right in half.
This is a thin phone that you can fold right in half, and it does serve a couple of, you know, kind of interesting functional differences. The first is they don't need to put a camera on the front side of the phone because you can fold the phone in half, and then you have the best phone, the best camera on your phone that you can use if you are taking selfies or you know, something like that. The image quality difference there is certainly noticeable. The battery life on these, despite being a phone that folds in half, is surprisingly good. It definitely is an issue that they have had in the past that have, you know, kind of done really well. You know, because it is a super thin phone, there are a couple things you're going to do on it that may cause it to feel warm in your hand pretty quick compared to some of the other phones, just because of how thin it is.
Now, do people who have them, do they fit better in pockets? I mean, do they like that it's smaller?
They do absolutely fit better in pockets, and just about any kind of pocket you can imagine, including you know, workout shorts and things like that. You know, it's just easier to kind of tuck them away in. They take up less space in you know, gear bags or purses or anything like that. They're pretty easy to find in those contexts. There are definitely some benefits to having it. One is just that even when the phone is completely open, it's just not as tall and, you know, kind of narrow as some of its competitors, which makes it easier to use with one hand, which is a thing we used to be able to do with phones.
Mm. Now, I'm very married to having a case on my phone. I have an OtterBox so that if I drop it, nothing bad is going to happen. Can you put a case on a phone that folds? Like, do they sell cases that also fold to so that you protect
it? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly the way you described it. There is OtterBox. In fact, the same company makes plenty of cases for both Samsung and Motorola folding phones, and they hold up very well in those situations.
Okay, so it doesn't necessarily, just because it's thinner and folds in half, it doesn't break more easily. Or does it?
It can break more easily. You know, there are certain you know, durability tests where it's not going to hold up nearly as well if you try and do the old school, you know, Motorola Razr, you know, like flip the phone out with your thumb kind of thing. Then you are, you know, presenting a risk. This is not a switchblade. It is in fact a $1,300 phone. So you'll need to be kind of, you know, careful in some cases with its use. But yeah, I mean, early versions of these phones had some pretty serious fragility issues that have largely been dealt with in these versions. But it's unlikely that we're going to find, even within the next couple of years, a flip phone that is exactly as durable as a standard candy bar design.
And you mentioned it's $1,300. How does that compare with new phones coming out now?
It is definitely on the pricey side. Yeah. These are... you know, again, Motorola being a company that used to assemble phones in the United States, but no longer does after, you know, the brand mark was sold to Google and then resold to another company. They don't operate here in the US anymore. So a lot of those phones are just naturally going to be more expensive for a little while. But even then, flip phones tend to be, you know, between $100 and $300 more expensive than their counterparts. And you know, offer a lot of the same features, which, you know, can be frustrating if you want a phone to last you, you know, 3 to 4 years.
Is Apple going to make a flip phone?
That has been a question that has been on quite a few people's mind for a while now. Apple has never fully committed to one design or the other. Apple also historically waits until a lot of the, you know, bugs are out of different hardware designs before stepping into a market. So if Apple were to announce a flip phone, it's unlikely that it would do so this year. But, you know, by the time we get to 2027, it wouldn't surprise me if Apple, you know, kind of blew everyone away with their take on a flip phone.
Hmm. All right. Well, and our final topic today is today marks the first day of Google's I/O conference, and it's online and open to the public. So, Russell, are you planning on attending some of parts of the conference?
I always listen. I'm always a big fan of Google's developer conference. It gives the opportunity to, you know, share with the entire world what Google hopes that its developers will adopt, you know, for all of their products, not just Android phones, but also tablets and televisions and the entertainment systems and cars. You know, there's a lot of different things that will get announced over the next 2 days that are, you know, kind of new tools for people who make apps to use in order to, you know, to make, you know, new opportunities for us as users. It also gives us a good look at what Google is planning on doing through the rest of the year with its Android software. Mm. You know, so this we'll get a look at what the next version of Android is, you know, going to be all about, aside from, you know, just its name, which is going to be Android 16. And, you know, what announcements come along with that. It should be no surprise to anyone listening that Google is going to lean very heavily into artificial intelligence, which is something that it had started doing on phones really before we called it AI. It was machine learning back then. Mm-hmm. You know, how, you know, their Gemini platform is going to, you know, try and make our lives just a little bit easier through all of its different apps. Whether that ends up being a hit out of the box or whether Gemini goes back to telling us how much glue to put in pizza is kind of a mixed bag. But, you know, this announcement will be where a lot of that information gets, you know, presented to everyone for the first time.
All right. So next week, we'll have to talk about what is actually announced. But we have about 1 minute left. And so since if we have 1 minute, can you give us an update on the CNET tariff tracker that you have going on? Any big updates there?
We definitely noticed prices going up in a couple of different areas. There was, you know, not just pricing, but availability issues that we detected specifically on Amazon over the weekend. If you are a big fan of things like 3D printers and, you know, kind of maker technology, a lot of the prices for the accessories around those have gone up within the last couple of weeks. We're also seeing prices on commodities like AA batteries, you know, slowly starting to increase. And that could very well be in anticipation for kind of an artificial price drop ahead of the Memorial Day weekend, where we'll end up seeing a lot of those kind of prices, which is a good opportunity to remind everyone here that there is an online tool called Camel that allows you to check the price history of something on Amazon to know whether something is actually on sale before buying it.
Did you call that tool Camel, like the animal?
Yep. Okay. Yeah, just three times in a row. Can't miss it.
All right. Thank you. I will. I'll check out Camel. That was Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.